said it was the greatest short story ever written. Charles Dickens called it the greatest short story of all time. Shakespeare's Henry IV was heavily influenced by this story. It's said to be the longest parable in the Bible. Anybody have a guess of what parable that I'm talking about? That's it, Joy. I knew she'd be the one to get it. Yeah. Parable of the Prodigal Son. The term prodigal is not actually part of the original words. It was credited to St. Jerome in the 4th century. He titled this section in Latin, Philus Prodigus, which means wasteful. And it's actually about two sons. We focused on the prodigal son, but it's actually about two sons, and it's when you step back about what this is in response to, there are three parables. It's in a group of three parables about the joy of finding something that was once lost. So I'd like to go through the story of the prodigal son, but I want to back up to the previous two parables to give context to what the prodigal son is actually addressing. So if you want to turn with me to Luke 15, we're going to camp out here. I'm going to be talking about this whole chapter. There'll be some verses in and out, but for the most part, we're just going to be in Luke 15. So, Luke 15, verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "The man welcomes sinners and eats with them." It's interesting. Every time I see the word tax collector in different verses, it's always the Pharisees muttering about them, which I would do the same. So why did the Pharisees hate the tax collectors so much? This is just a side point. Because they were collaborators with the Roman government, with an occupying force. They were kind of their agents. And they routinely collected some extra taxes for themselves. And this was confirmed in Luke 19. You don't have to turn there. But Zacchaeus confirmed this practice in verse 8. Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Lord, look, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay four times the amount." Which I find funny because if you're a tax collector, I think Connie, you're not a tax collector, you're an accountant, you would know if you're cheating somebody. So it's not if, you probably did. So I don't like tax collectors in the IRS either, but not for the same reasons as the Pharisees did. But anyways, they're grouped together with the sinners, and they're wondering why Christ is eating with them and hanging out with them. So let's start with the first parable. And it's the parable of lost sheep. It's a short one. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and say, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. So the sheep wandered off and got lost. And at some point, probably the sheep knew it was lost and looking for a way back. But it needed help. It needs someone to go look for the sheep. And the next short parable is about a lost coin. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and say, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you that there is rejoicing in presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. And I've lost plenty of things in my life, nothing really of that much value, but it is joyful when you find something lost. Back in 2013, there was a Welsh computer engineer, James Howells, and you probably heard this story before, talking about coins. He mistakenly disposed of a laptop hard drive containing the private keys for 8,000 Bitcoin in the Doxway landfill in Newport, Wales. In today's value, it's worth about $950 million that he threw away. Needless to say, for the last 12 years, he has been trying to find out how to search and find these Bitcoin in the landfill. After 12 years, he has publicly said he's given up. And so, do you think he's ever going to forget about those Bitcoins? I don't think so. It's always going to be in the back of his mind. But instead of joy of finding it, there's sadness that he lost it. So how sad is God when he loses one of us? And how much joy when we are found? So what's the difference between the two lost items? Well, the lost sheep actively wandered away, and the sheep knew it was lost. While the lost coin was lost through neglect. The contrast emphasizes God's diligent search. Those who wandered off and are lost, and those who do not know they are lost, are both lost. So let's continue on to the parable of the lost sons or the prodigal son. In verse 11, Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to the father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them." So we've all read and heard this parable many times. And every time I go through it, I learned something new, and I know a lot of this will be a refresher, but maybe you'll get one or two pieces of information or insight that you haven't before. And there's a reason it's called the greatest short story ever written. There's so many different nuances and so many different things to learn from the details of this parable. So if my sons asked me for an inheritance before I was dead, I would be greatly offended, and this father was too, I'm sure. Because as we know, that's not something that's done. You don't ask for your inheritance until your father passes away. So this was a great sign of disrespect. And there's lots of questions about how we got to this point. It was an insolent and a disrespectful demand, but he wanted cashed out. He didn't want to have anything to do with what was going on with his father and the estate or the expectations or any of that. He wanted out. It's an absurd and unreasonable request. He wants the father's wealth and his things, but he doesn't want a relationship with the father. So essentially, the younger son is saying, "I wish you were dead so I could get my inheritance." He wanted out of the family, out of the community, and he dishonored his father by rejecting everything about him. So why would the father agree to do this? Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, they've all committed to giving away 99% of their wealth because I think they know that obscene amount of wealth to their kids could be a problem. Too much money is fuel on the fire for those that are morally weak. Too much money can cause a lack of creativity and drive, and a massive inheritance can destroy a work ethic. But desperation can sometimes push innovation, and I think these wealthy people know that. So why did the father divide the estate, even though he knew what was going to happen? Well, the father was playing the long game. Some need to hit rock bottom in order to change. Some people learn hard. So what would have happened if the father said no, slapped him upside the head, and said, "No, you don't get this inheritance. You don't have any right to it." I think the son would have been bitter his whole life and would have never gotten over it. Some kids just have to touch that hot stove, which can cause a lot of pain, but when they do learn it, it's rock solid. You don't have to tell them again. So it's a challenge of parenting style, and I think anybody with kids has always wrestled between, do you protect or allow your kids to learn a lesson by natural consequences, or are you just protecting from it? So the father here said, well, okay, this is what you want. Have at it. So how did this transaction happen? The father's estate was primarily in land. And part of the land was part of the family identity, not just an investment. So under Mosaic tradition, inheritance couldn't be divided until after the death of the father. So the sons became a usufructuary. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Usufructuary. A usufructuary is a person who holds the right to use the benefit from a property even though they don't earn it. Remember, even though they don't own it. So the father would still own the land until he died, but the sons could profit from it. So that's what is generally thought of what has happened here with the inheritance. And the younger likely liquidated his share of the usage of the land so they could set off, you know, so they could sell it and get money to do what he wanted to do. And we see that in verse 13. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, which was his one-third share of the inheritance. As we know, the older would get the two-thirds double share. And set off for a distant country. And there squandered his wealth in wild living. So the Greek word for wild living is asotos, which describes a lifestyle of recklessness and debauchery. Someone who wastes their resources thoughtfully. He went far away because he didn't want to be held accountable to his family. And after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to the citizen of the country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. And we know that's about the lowest of the low. For the Israelites, obviously pigs are unclean, and to have to feed them and work with them is pretty bad. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. So this is about as low as you can go. This is rock bottom, and he was definitely desperate. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set you out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants,'" which would be better than what he was doing now. So this was a rehearsed speech. Was he truly repentant? I don't think so. I think he was desperate. And desperation leads to innovation, and this was his best idea at the time. I don't think he was sincere at this point, but he sees a way out. So verse 20, he got up and went to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and, filled with compassion for him, ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. So his father was always on the lookout for him, never gave up on him. Every day was looking out for him. And he didn't wait for his speech. So why did he run? Why did the father run? Because this was something that was thought of as humiliating, you know. Father figures back in those days, they don't run. That's something that kids do. And you had a robe on. So if you're going to run, you got to hike up your robe and you got to run. It looks ridiculous. So why did he do that? Obviously, it was the joy of his lost son coming home. He ran in joy. But it was also to protect his son from the community of shunning him. He willingly endures the shame to save his son from the community's rejection. So Jewish tradition called a kazaz ceremony, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It's where a pot is filled with burnt beans. It's broken at the feet of a disgraced individual as they try to come back to the community. It symbolizes their permanent and shameful exclusion from the community and the family. So likely the father was trying to protect his son from this ceremony and a public shunning. So the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." And this is where the father cut him short and said, but the father said to his servant, "Quick, bring the best robes and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet." Father didn't even let him finish his speech. So that signet ring that he gave him, it means that he was accepted back into the family, and it granted him immense privilege, treated him as royalty. And this was a family of probably fairly substantial means. It's a full recognition to be reinstated in the family. And the robe covered up his rags to cover up the disappointing gazes. So in verse 23, we continue, "Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. I'll defer to Sam on this one, but people don't just usually have fatted calves laying around for an occasion. And from what I understand, fatted calf means grain-fed in this context. So to have an extra fatted calf on hand would be unusual. It must have been selected well in advance for another celebration, but instead it was used for the son's return. So what was the relationship between the father and the younger son at this point? Well, obviously the father had an unconditional love and forgiveness and mercy for his son, even after all the disrespect and humiliation of the son caused him. What about the son? Well, he was in desperate need. Did he love his father at this point? I'm a pessimist. I don't think so. Probably not at this point, but he needed his father, and that's a start. That's the first step in the reconciliation of the relationship. So the story offers hope to anyone who has strayed, reminding them that it is never too late to find a way back to God and his forgiveness. I know of a young person recently who kind of lost their way, lived on the streets, got into drugs, eventually snapped out of it. The family came and brought some sense into this person. But this person still feels broken. Doesn't feel like they can ever be forgiven. And of course, there are things in our lives, there are things that you do that do have permanent damage on a mental and physical level. But as far as our spiritual life, God is ready to accept us and forgive us. So the story's not over, though. What about the older brother? So we continue in verse 25. "Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing." It's odd that he wasn't invited beforehand, right? But I think the father knew that he was not going to be helpful in a celebration of the younger son coming back. This shouldn't have been someone probably should have got him earlier, but there's probably a reason. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders." Slaving and disobeying, never disobeyed. "Yet you never gave me a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends." The son wanted recognition for being a good son. "Look at everything I've done. Look what everything he's done. You treat him better than you treat me." But in verse 30, but when this son of yours has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." So he can't understand why the younger son is being rewarded for bad behavior. And on in verse 31, "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours." But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So what's the relationship between the father and the older son? The Pharisees would have definitely identified with the older son and brother. And honestly, I do too. They would have agreed that the older son was mistreated. But the relationship between the older son and his father was transactional. He worked hard for his father because he loved him. It says in verse 29, let's go over that. He slaved for his father. Well, that sounds like a transactional reason. You're working hard to get something that you want. He was more like a servant than a son, investing his time to get what he wanted. Hop over here to Galatians 4, verse 7. You don't have to go there. I'll just read it real quick, but if you want to write it down, Galatians 4, verse 7. So Paul says, "So you are no longer a slave, but God's child. And since you are his child, God has made you also an heir." You're an heir because you're a child of God. Not because you're a slave, not because of these things. So why was the son so diligent about obeying? It's not out of love, but for his dad's stuff, his inheritance. I would say he was angrily faithful. Focus on the inheritance over the relationship. Motivation and attitude matters to God, not just blind obedience. And strict obedience is not a replacement for a healthy relationship with God. And the son was also angry at this undeserved grace given to his younger brother. Felt like the younger son faced no consequences for his actions. There was a resentment over this undeserved grace for the younger brother. And it was undeserved. He wasn't wrong to think that the younger brother didn't deserve grace. He was wrong to think that somehow he was more deserving because he had done everything that he was supposed to do. He felt that by the father giving the younger brother grace and forgiveness, it somehow diminished his efforts. You know, logically, we know that grace is not a zero-sum game. It's given freely. So why don't we like it when we see somebody get something that they don't deserve? Because I think it feels like that our efforts are not fully recognized. Think about different times with our kids going to school and the different ways that they do projects. And they'll have group projects where everybody collaborates together and they all get a shared grade. Well, some of the students inevitably will work harder than the others. But the longer, I see college students, they probably are more familiar with this. The longer the project goes on, the more I think people try to figure out how little they can work and still get that grade. And I think human nature would suggest, well, if there's no consequence to my actions and we're all sharing a grade, then why should I work so hard? And I think that was the attitude of the older son. Like, why am I killing my, why am I doing all this? So what was the father's reaction to the older son? The father had to leave the celebration to deal with the pouting older son, right? But he wanted to affirm the older son. The father reassures him, the older son, that his inheritance and his place in the family are set. The grace of the younger did not diminish the older son's standing. And the father wanted the older to share the joy of the younger son. And there was a gentle correction by reminding the son that he's your brother. Because the older brother described him as this son of yours. in verse 30. And in verse 32, the father said, no, this brother of yours. So it was important to remind him that he had a role as a brother. So there's similarities between the relationships with the father, between both of the sons. Both sons were lost, but only one knew that he was. They both had a transactional relationship with the father. One just cashed it in all at once, crashed and burned. The other was more patient, playing the long game, extracted what he wanted over time. But both had no love for the father. What about the relationship between the brothers? The older brother didn't love his younger brother. Why didn't the older try to mediate between the two when this first came about? Obviously, there wasn't a good enough relationship there, because that would have been expected of the older brother in this situation when there was a dispute between the father and younger, is that the older would come in and mediate. There's no evidence that that happened, so we assume that there really wasn't a relationship between the brothers. So why didn't he? Why didn't he step in? Probably because he'd served his purpose as well. Because when the father divvied up the usury of the land, he got his portion as well. He got to profit from it. So he was a passive, silent participant in this whole scheme. The older son would have received a double portion of inheritance. So the older son actually benefited from the younger requesting inheritance early. Even though they didn't actually own it, they were able to use the proceeds and profit from it. So why wasn't he happy to see his brother? He already got everything he wanted. You know, there's a lot of similarities between the prodigal and parable son and Jacob and Esau. Both dealt with inheritance and a complex relationship with the brothers and forgiveness. But we see in Genesis 33:4, but Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Esau got tricked into giving him his birthright, and he forgave. He forgave Jacob. We don't know. We don't know if the older son forgave his son or his father or his brother. It doesn't say how he reacted towards the end. But it's interesting that the description in Jacob 33:4 is very similar to how the father reacted to the prodigal son coming. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. So did the older brother ever reconcile with the younger and embrace him? Like I said, we don't know. Parable stops with a conclusion that was meant to be open-ended as a message to the Pharisees to say, well, you tell me. This is a choose-your-own-adventure ending. I'm not going to end it for you. You get to end it. So what are the responsibilities to our brothers and sisters in Christ? Are we just waiting for the Father to bring them back? Are we even looking for them? Do we even know they're suffering? You know, for a long time, I sympathized with the older son. I always thought that he just needed a little attitude adjustment. And in the same light, even Job, I said, well, self-righteousness, it's just a minor thing. It's not that big of a deal. And I've thought that way for a long time. I've always thought Job was treated unfairly, simply for the small fact that he was self-righteous. But if we measure the impact of sin by how far it separates us from God, then self-righteousness is one of the most dangerous sins. It's dangerous because it's not easily detected. It's a stealth sin. We can't change our ways if we don't know we're sinning. The older brother certainly couldn't see it, and it caused his heart to be hardened. One of the signs of self-righteousness is a lack of compassion. We see that the older brother didn't have any compassion for his father or brother. It's all inward thinking. What can I get for myself? And the truth is, and this may be hard for you to hear, Both those who reject God and those who keep all the rules can be just as far from knowing God. So what about us? How do we measure our love for God? By how well we keep the commandments? So in John 14, verse 15, we see, if we love God, we will keep his commandments. It's pretty clear. If we love God, we will keep his commandments. But does this mean that if we keep the commandments, we love God? Can we flip that around? And I think the message that we see in this and many themes throughout the Bible is not necessarily. You can go through the motions. You can keep the law, but that doesn't mean you love him. But if you love God, you will keep the commandments. But if you keep the commandments, it doesn't necessarily mean that you love God. The Pharisees kept the commandments. 1 John 4, verse 12. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. Whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or sister is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother and sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. So our relationship with God and our fellow man don't exist in isolation. And a big test of our love for God is how we love each other. So in conclusion, we are all valuable in God's eyes, whether we had wandered off or not. Sometimes we are like the lost sheep and the prodigal son. Sometimes we get lost because we've wandered off. We need to know how to find our way back. Who can we count on to help us get back? Sometimes we're like the older son, or the lost coin, or Bitcoin. We're lost and we don't even know it. We need to be constantly checking to see if we're lost. But hopefully, most of the time, we're in a position of the Father, constantly searching for those that are lost and welcoming them back with joy and forgiveness.